what I thought was the funniest part of the book really made me actually laugh out loud was when Paul Benowitz wrote to the president and he got the letter back the form letter about not investigating UFOs.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, he was working with the Air Force, he thought, investigating UFOs. So I thought that was probably one of the funniest parts of the book. I really wish I'd been a fly on the wall for that.
Well, I don't know. It seems like the standard letter they would send out to anybody that asked about UFOs. The funny thing about all the stuff that was going on at the time is that Richard Doty, Ernest Edwards, other people at the base and the OSI, AFOSI, were feeding him all kinds of stories that he was mixing up with what he thought was going on, and then he was starting to write letters, or he had been writing letters to congressmen, senators, the president, everybody, and I think they were getting some of the blowback from this and having to explain what was going on with Paul.
All right, and when you started doing the research for this book, wow, was Doty like this impossible to get a hold of guy, as shadowy as he sounds, or how do you go about even getting a hold of him? Because he sounds pretty mysterious.
Bill Moore was still in touch with him, so I asked him to kind of pave the way for me. It took a few months for him to actually get to the point where he'd even answer an email. And when he did answer an email, I sent him, I don't know, 20 questions or so, and about half of them came back no comment. And so I got more involved with it with him. And then I told him in an email that I was coming out to New Mexico, so Bill called him up again and said, hey, Greg's coming out. He's not trying to make fun of anybody or, you know, doesn't have an agenda really to push, I don't think. So it'd probably be a good idea for you to talk to him. So he said, okay, I'll meet you at a Denny's. So he met me at a Denny's about 40 miles east of Albuquerque. And I had to be there so of course I got there like, you know, 20 minutes early and just hung out. And then it's a weird thing about government people that everyone I've met with, they say, I'm going to be there at 3. You set your clock to the atomic clock or whatever, your watch, and at the second it turns 3 o'clock, they show up. I think they hang around somewhere and wait. So I did the same thing. And I walked up just to see, I said, okay, it's, you know, 2 minutes to 3. I left the mall where I was, drove across the parking lot, and walked into the door. And at the second, at 3, you know, 4 or 5, whenever I met him, as I walked in the door, he was walking at the same time. We sat down and talked. I asked him if I could record it, and he said no. So, and I brought along a map of Kirtland Air Force Base that I had, and we sat down and started to talk, and he stayed with me as long as I wanted to get everything I wanted to get out of him, which turned out to be, I think, over 3 hours.
Oh, wow.
And then he gave me his number. Oh, actually, I had his number before because I had to call him when I was in New Mexico. Anyway, and he said, well, call me if you have any other questions, no problem. And that's how it went. I had to drive back to Albuquerque running the entire thing through my mind over and over again. As soon as I got to the hotel, I sat down for about 2 hours and typed out probably 4 or 5 single-spaced pages, everything I could possibly remember that we'd said.
Yeah, that must have been tough to, wow, yeah, 3 hours and no recording. That must have been like...
Yeah, I mean, there was small talk, too, but I try to remember the, you know, important points of what he told me. And then later, of course, I said, you know, this is what I put in the book. Is this how you remember it? And he said, yeah, that's fine. So, I mean, you know, keeping in mind that he told me as much as he needed to tell me or wanted to tell me. But that's fine. I mean, that's all you're going to get. I emphasize in the book that... if you're going to play the game with these people, you have to play the game. You can't be scared or thinking they're lying to you all the time because you'll never get anywhere. You have to get what you can out of them and then try and check it.
Yeah. Now, what was his reaction to you writing a book? Was he, was he cool about it, or was he kind of like cautious?
He didn't seem to have any problem with it.
Oh. All right, well, you never know. You know, some people are like, you know, I didn't know if he was, you know, wary of that kind of attention or something like that.
No, he didn't ask me to, you know, I don't even think he asked me to look at what I was going to write. The reason I told him is I showed him, is because I wanted to make sure that there wasn't something that I quoted wrong or taken out of context or whatever.
Yeah.
He didn't suggest anything change. He didn't suggest it to, you know, he didn't suggest any changes. He didn't say I'd gotten anything wrong. So it was actually pretty smooth going with him. As I said, there were some things he told me which I knew probably were not true, and then later I found either I couldn't substantiate them, or in a couple of cases Bill said, I know that's not right. I don't know why he said that, but it sounds typical, the kind of thing that he'll do to people. So he'll give you a few bad roads to go down if you choose to do them just because they sound good.
Really?
I tried to ignore those.
So
he was doing that on the Art Bell show, too, but then, of course, he was also talking about some stuff that had some validity to it, as far as I could tell.
Yeah, that's pretty strange. He just throws out bogus nuggets there. And
yeah, so there's people that are big, like, fans of Richard Doty or that kind of thing, and they tend to believe a lot of the stuff he says, or people that have some sort of agenda, like Lear and Cooper and all those people back in the 80s that will believe almost anything that comes out of somebody's mouth as long as it sounds good, not even good, but sounds sensationalized and is something that the next guy didn't say before so that they'll get the attention, I think. It's like this one-upmanship thing, and government people use that to their advantage. Paul wasn't doing that. He was just trying to find out things on his own. He wasn't, he didn't want to go appear on radio shows, write a book, or do anything. He thought he was doing something very important that had to do with the safety of the human race and the planet, etc. But like I said, you have to listen to these people, and you can't just believe everything they say. And then on the other hand, you can't say, well, they lie all the time, so why should I believe anything? That's their job. I mean, and if you know what you're talking about, and you know the questions to ask, and you know to be patient to check these things out, then you'll get something out of it. If not, if you don't let research and what you think is substantiated truth guide you, then it is kind of useless to talk to these people.
All right. Now, yesterday we were talking about Bill Moore.
Yeah.
And I kind of was like, well, let's wait till tomorrow because I know I'm going to have a ton of questions about him, but just give me a
subject.
What's that?
The big subject.
Yeah. Well, give me like a little thumbnail sketch of you. In the book, you say you kind of, when you first got into like following ufology, you worked with him a little bit at the MUFON, the famous MUFON convention at this point. So why don't you tell me first just about how you met him and you know, that kind of thing.
Well, the way I met him was that I was looking for a project, a friend of mine and I were looking for a project to do on video, and I was sort of interested in the UFO subject again after many years of not being interested in it. You know, I was like, 10 or 12, I stopped reading all the UFO books. And then around, 21, 22 years old, I started reading them again. And at that point, I thought, well, there's going to be a convention here. Bill Moore, Stanton Friedman, other people are going to be speaking there. So why don't we ask if we can just videotape them and then split the sales with them? So we got Bill Moore, Stan Friedman, and Bud Hopkins, of all people, to agree to this. We signed little contracts. I videotaped them, and the tape never sold that well. But as it turned out, that wasn't the point. The point was, a few years later, I started this magazine with a couple friends of mine, Robert Larson and Peter Stenzel, called The Excluded Middle. And about the third issue along, I had been, hanging out with Bill, asking him questions. Basically, I wasn't trying to be his friend. I was just interested in hearing what he had to say, especially after Vegas, because that was after Vegas. Maybe I should jump back to Las Vegas. He said he was going to be at the MUFON convention that year, and he was going to say something that was going to, blow everybody away and be this incredible thing, and a lot of people would be mad at him, but he wouldn't tell me what it was. So I went to Vegas by myself, met him there, and he had a table set up with stuff, so I, kind of helped him and a couple. Actually, he didn't show up at the convention until his talk. So, like, an assistant of his and I just kind of manned the table, I did my, kind of had some time and wandered about. And then Bill did his, came up and did his speech, and I'd never seen any group of people so affected by a talk. I said in the book, people, if I'd have known it was going to be that bad, I would have sold rotten vegetables outside before the talk, because the thing was continually interrupted by people yelling at him and saying, "Where'd you get that crap from, Bill?" And, you know, one guy came, ran out, got up and loudly announced, "I'm going to get a fire hose," and walked out of the talk. People were crying. It was weird. It was very weird. And so after that, I just thought, well, this is something I'd like to find out what caused all this emotion. So a few years later, when I was doing the magazine, I interviewed Bill, and that was reproduced in a bunch of different places. And as the years went on, we just hung out because we both live in Los Angeles, and became friends that way. And so I would ask him more and more, you know, important, intimate questions about what went on. And when I decided to start writing a book, that was one of the proposals I sent out. You know, there were like three or four of them. And luckily, Patrick Wage and Simon & Schuster said, "Well, that's the one we want." So I told Bill, "Would you help me with this? Since if I sign this contract," he said, "Yeah, sure." So it went ahead from that. That was my entry into that, and it was the best place to walk into it, I think.
Yeah, that's for sure. How long was his working arrangement with the government?
Probably from about that first meeting in 1980, I think early 1980, up to, it kind of petered out in the late 80s, like 88 or so, 86, 88.
And what was the, like, what was the...
The agreement?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you took the words right out of my mouth. What was the agreement?
The agreement was he would basically answer their questions about who was doing what and thinking what in the UFO community, to make sure that they didn't have some sort of security leak and didn't have infiltrators in the UFO community trying to find out military secrets. And in exchange, Bill would get classified UFO information that nobody else was getting. Actually, the first thing they gave him was fake. Not the Weitzel letter, but another thing called the Silver Sky document. They handed that to him at the first meeting or second meeting and said, "Why don't you check this out?" And so he went and checked it out, and he came back to them, and he said he checked out the names and the dates and all that, and they didn't match, and the people didn't exist, or at least they didn't live in the places that the document said they did. So he brought it back and said, "This is, you know, what'd you give me this for? This is fake." And he says he remembers sitting there and shoving the envelope back across the red tablecloth to them, and he said, "Falcon and Doty both smiled and said, 'Good, you passed the test.'" And what the test was, they would give him stuff, but they didn't want him going out and spouting it all over the place. I don't know why. I think it's because they wanted to make it appear that there was somebody who was doing their homework and was circumspect about things, so that whatever they gave to him would have the kind of the air of, not authority, but at least caution behind it.
Yeah, it would be vetted by research.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think Falcon cared whether there was any UFO research being affected or if there was anything, you know, going to be revealed. He revealed as much as he had to through his channels to Bill Moore so that Moore would keep up his end of the bargain. In fact, they gave Bill Moore, they sent him through, like, spy school, essentially.
Oh, really?
They taught him how to follow people and how to, you know, how to ask questions and how to get things out of people and do surveillance and all that.
No kidding. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned that in the book, and also the fact that they had him do other things besides UFO stuff. They actually had him, you know, try and track down people that were in the L.A. area that they were...
Oh, okay. Yep. I remember that story. I remember that story now.
Yeah. They messed with him a little bit, but they also had him do actual real work.
Now, did they tell him that they were trying to weed out foreign spies, or...
No, they didn't tell him that at the time, but he kind of put it together after a while.
Okay, so at first he just thought they wanted to know what was going on in ufology.
Yeah. And, of course, he couldn't say anything to anybody about it, so he didn't until all that had basically blown over and they weren't using him anymore, and he figured, well, he said it in the speech, you know, "I was never asked to shut up about it, so I'm going to tell you what happened." And most people read it as, "I know something you don't, and you're all full of crap." But the thing was, what he was trying to say, and he was a little upset with everybody at that point because he couldn't say what he was doing, and people were saying things, throwing rocks at him, you know, metaphorically. And they had no idea what he was doing and what he had been through because he never said anything about it. So he lost a lot of patience with them, and he said, you know, I guess I wouldn't have been so arrogant if I had to do it over again. But they didn't know what he was doing, so, I mean, the reaction was understandable, but the time that it's taken people to cool off from it, and in a lot of cases still not listen to what he said is kind of amazing to me. Although, you know, when you bring up his name, there's a lot less, unless there's people that just have a bone to pick, there's a lot less hostility towards that episode in Bill Moore now. And I don't think I could have written the book in, you know, 1995 or whatever. I think now, there's been enough time that people actually listen and take things into account.
Why do you think that you couldn't have written it in 95, that people...
There's too many, well, I could have written it then. The reaction would have been different. There would have been still people around that were still very irritated and upset. Now there's not. I mean, people remember it, and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, that thing. Not, you know, that asshole Bill Moore. It's more like, oh, yeah, I wonder what really happened with that. And the funny thing is I've talked to a few people who I won't mention on the air that said, well, yeah, I knew that all the time. And these were people that were yelling at him at the time.
Really?
Yeah, so there's a lot of people that are in here, I think, in the field to, one, because it's really interesting. I mean, you can't doubt that. But two, because they think they can make some sort of name for themselves doing it. And, you know, yeah, I'm on the show with you, and I went on Art Bell and all that, but it's basically to get the book sold so people will read it and I can write more books. And the fact that it had to be something that I was involved in, peripherally, personally, and had access to these people just made it a lot more interesting and enjoyable for me to do.
Now, do you think he got anything good out of this agreement, like good information? Like, is there anything?
No, there's a few things he got out of it that were good. The story of the MJ-12 documents, the Eisenhower briefing document, that's a direct result of his agreement with them to watch Paul Dennewitz and other people. He got, well, Jamie Chandray got that package in the mail. Now, a lot of people think it's fake now. Even Bill thinks it's fake. But the funny thing is, he never said, this is absolutely genuine, which everybody claims that he did. And I've read his articles on the subject all the way back to when he first got it. And, he did say what he said he did. He said, this looks genuine as far as I can tell, but we don't know for sure. And he has a book called The MJ-12 Documents, which he released with everything he'd gotten up to that point, describing what it was, reproducing it, and the research he and Jamie and I think Stanton Friedman had done on the documents, the Eisenhower document, the Aquarius document, the Kirtland things that came out, and the Carter briefing document, if you've heard of that, went through all these things and said, you know, and examined each one of them individually in detail and pronounced, you know, this seem, you know, he never said this is genuine. He said this seems genuine, this doesn't seem genuine, this is questionable. He is very careful about it, but, you know, because people want things in black and white, they'll say, well, he pushed all this on the UFO community, said it was genuine and knew it was fake. Well, no, he knew that it probably, he didn't know whether they were fake or not, but proceeded to try and figure out if they were. The funny thing is, the upshot of the whole thing, I asked him, I don't know if this is in the book, but I asked Bill, well, what do you think, you know, over the course of, you know, talking to him over many years, and especially the last couple, I said, well, after all this, what do you think's going on? And he said, I think there's an alien, there's some sort of extra human presence here, but I don't know, and the government knows about it. But beyond that, I don't know what they think about it or what they're going to do with it. And I went further than anybody else ever did, and I couldn't figure it out, so which is why I stopped. You know, he said he ran into so many dead ends on it that he just said, you know, either it doesn't exist or there's somebody that very high up that really doesn't want us to mess with it, you know, get to the center of it.
And he just stopped investigating altogether after...
Yeah, he's written a book on the, you know, origins of the Mormon Church. That's what he's been doing for the last 8 or 10 years. It just came out.
When now was that? Did he stop investigating like right after that MUFON convention, or like?
Oh no, he kept going for a while. Probably somewhere in the mid to late 90s, he finally gave up on it because he couldn't get it. He said, "I just couldn't get it." Jacques Vallée said exactly the same thing in so many words. When I asked him about it, I said, well, why don't you, I saw him a couple of years ago somewhere, and I have an incredible amount of respect for him, so I just said, you know, why aren't you involved in the UFO subject anymore? He says, because I'm not learning anything from it. At some point, a lot of these people get to the point where they've been running around in circles for years and had a few stabs at maybe what an answer is or whatever, but it never gets them anywhere. They know a little bit more than they did, but not so much that it's going to change anything, and especially their own personal views. You know, that they come out, that most of them come up with exactly what Bill did. There's something here, some people in power know about it, but past that, I don't know what's at the center of that.
Going back to Bill Moore, at what point during the saga did he decide to, reveal all to the ufology field? Like, he must have been getting either fed up or it wasn't worth it anymore. Or at what point was he, like, decide to make this big revelation?
Probably about a year or so before he did it. I don't know. He didn't really talk about it until right before the convention there in 1989. So I don't know when he made the decision. Probably, you know, if you're talking about a time frame when he might have said, okay, that's it, you know. Well, what do you mean, the decision to give up or the decision to make the announcement?
Oh, the decision to make the announcement.
Oh, it because he was getting nothing more from by the late 80s there, he was getting nothing, mid to late 80s, he wasn't getting anything else from his contacts anymore. They had stopped asking him for information, and they had stopped giving it to him, so he figured that their little, there was no time frame on it, but he figured their agreement was basically finished. So he said, well, I've got nothing to lose, maybe if I put this out in the community, something will come back that's useful, and we can learn something. But all he got was a bunch of people mad at him, and maybe two or three or few people pretty soon after saying, I think what you said was interesting and I'd like to help you, but none of that really panned out.
And
because maybe he did get further than anybody else at that point.
It sounds like he, yeah, well, it's really a fascinating, you don't hear that too many ufologists that openly admit that sort of thing, that they're in contact with the government and they work with them.
No, there were a few other people, and Bill says he knew about them and he knew who they were, but it's not his business to reveal who they are. That's their business, because they're still alive, all of them, apparently.
Yeah, I know. That was a fascinating, that was like one of those things you look, and you end up thinking about it for a while after you read something like that, because you're like, I wonder who that could be.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that their contributions are any less valuable, I think.
Oh, no, I mean,
it just means that if you're dealing with them on a personal level, then if they tell you, hey, I heard that so-and-so, then you should probably check out what they say. Well, you should do that with anybody. But well, actually, which would make it no different. You hear something sensational, and you think, well, this would be great to announce, which a lot of people go right out and announce it without even checking on it. Some people say, well, let me check this out. And sometimes it'll take years for you to check out something somebody told you. There's a bunch of stuff I've been told that I'll probably never know if it's true or not.
Well, with somebody like Moore, the reason I think he was the most interesting guy in the book, too, is it's really, I couldn't find myself identifying with Benowitz, and I definitely couldn't identify with Doty, but I can really, you can really see, put yourself in Bill Moore's shoes, and I think it makes perfect sense what he did. I don't really have a problem with it, you know, only because this is sort of an individual quest for knowledge at times.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of took the, he never really was, you know, played well with others unless they had something that either he needed or something that was interesting. I mean, that's basically how you choose friends. I mean, you know, if you're smart, you don't hang around with people that are useless and take your time and effort and all that and give nothing back. And that's exactly how he is, but he's a lot less, you know, he's a lot less transparent about it. I mean, he's more transparent about it. He'll just say, well, I have nothing to gain from you, so, you know, have fun. I went to lunch with him and this radio producer about a month ago, and the guy's saying, oh, I finally get to meet Bill Moore, And as time went on, he wasn't getting the answers he wanted. He wasn't hearing what he wanted from Bill Moore, and Bill was actually questioning this guy's basic beliefs, like, well, why do you think that? Why do you think the government's about to reveal a bunch of stuff? Well, because so-and-so told me, and, you know, he said, well, you know, how do you trust that person? He just started questioning the guy about where his belief system came from. The guy got a little irritated, and after that, he didn't want to talk to Bill anymore. And before that, he was all excited to talk to him and, you know, possibly strike up some sort of relationship, but Bill was like, you know, if you're gonna persist in your delusions, or at least not support yourself, I'm not learning anything from you. So what, you know, why should I continue this conversation? He was polite. You know, he was a gentleman about it, but he's, you know, very firmly like, you know, if you can't support what you say, then we have nothing to talk about, unless you just want to listen to me. And discuss that and question my belief system, because he's fine with that too. A few times we almost got in our, you know, kind of arguments when I was working on the book, because I was like, why'd you do that? Didn't you have a problem with that? You know, why didn't you, you know, didn't you care people don't trust you anymore? Just things like that. And instead of getting mad, he would just, you know, kind of grit his teeth and say, you know, and tell me exactly why he did what he did.
Well, that's commendable, that at least, you know, it sounds like he's a strong character, so.
Yeah, very strong. I mean, he makes you realize that you a lot of your opinions are based on, you know, an emotion and very little else.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. Now, before he made the big revelation to ufology that he was working with the government, were there any rumors of it?
It was all over the place. People were already yelling at him.
Really? How long was that going on before he was like, well, I might as well come clean about this?
Oh, probably a year or two. I don't know exactly. I mean, I was just vaguely aware of what was going on at the time, just because, you know, my only inroad to that was Bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, and there wasn't an internet then, and I just had to hear from people what they were saying. And when I got to the convention, I realized how, you know, suspicious people were of him at that point. Because he, like, why does Bill get all these documents? Who mails these things to him? What's he doing here? Is he an agent that's just trying to spread, you know, disinformation? The funny thing is, they take some of the disinformation and repeat it.
Yeah.
If they thought it, you know, not specifically from Bill, but from the same people that were talking to Bill, although they didn't know it, I think in a few cases, the same milieu of intelligence people would say something, and they just run with it immediately. They didn't go check it out. They said, you know, aliens are living underground, and, you know, Edward Teller is running an alien testing an alien defense system, and blah, blah, blah. They didn't go and, you know, they didn't wait and say, you know, either go to see Edward Teller or talk to somebody that was involved with him or check up on it. They would just immediately stand up on the podium with, sometimes with a bunch of security guards around to make it look like something bad was going to happen and repeat all these paranoid stories that had been told to Paul Benowitz, had been concocted, not purposely, by Paul Benowitz and the people around him.
And the scene when he makes this revelation, that you were there, it must have been just people just keep shouting at him and everything. I really wish, like, I wish there was a video of it.
I have heard and talked to somebody that says he has a video of it. I'm still trying to get it from him. Because he said he taped it for the convention, but Moore did not allow it to be released anywhere, but he still has it. I said, this guy lives in Utah, I think around Moab or something. I said, well, where's... Do you know where the tape is? Oh, it's in my garage somewhere. I said, could you please find it? But I haven't bugged him in a few months here. I should start bugging him again. And somebody else I talked to recently said they had an audio tape of it. Phil Klaff has a tape of it because he was in the front row taping it with a little microcassette recorder.
Oh, man.
I remember seeing it. Every lecture, he'd sit in the front row with a tape recorder and record everything.
Wow.
I don't know why they allowed him to do that and nobody else, but apparently he was doing it.
You've been in ufology for a long time, would you say? You've at least followed it, right?
Followed it. I mean, I don't know if I'm in ufology, but it's very interesting to me.
Yeah, you're kind of the same way I am, so yeah. Well, you followed ufology, you studied the days of Benowitz and everything. How do you think it's evolved since then to today's, present-day ufology? Has it improved? Has
what the elephant in the living room thing about ufology is September 11th.
Really?
You notice that after that, you didn't hear anything about UFOs or ufology for like 2 or 3 years. Nobody cared about it. And MUFON, a lot of UFO organizations just hit, they went out of existence then. MUFON just barely held on. And now they're, making a little bit of a comeback. Because nobody cared about UFOs then. They were worried about whether they were going to get bombed.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way, but yeah, that's really that's an excellent point.
It basically shut everybody, people just didn't care about it because they were so riveted by this other thing that was very much important. Very important to a lot of people and to the way we thought of ourselves and our identity and how vulnerable we thought we were. And, you had to look out the window and wonder if somebody was going to crash a plane in a building outside. Because I lived near downtown L.A. at the time. I'd look out the window every day and just wonder. And I didn't care about UFOs too much at that point either. But I was in the middle of writing the book, so I just, trying to sell the book as a as an idea. So, it just kept my interest. But the ufology, I think, took a big nosedive then, and it's just, in the last couple of years starting to recover. And I think it's changed. People are a lot less, at least people that are really into the subject, are a lot less likely to just take anything at face value. I mean, people like Sean Morton and Michael Sala and people like that aside, I think people are at least serious, people that are serious about it are much more circumspect about what they're going to allow into their belief system. I think that's a direct result of that. And people that were just sort of interested in it, now probably either don't care or it's just, marginal to their interest.
Is that because of 9/11, you think?
I think it is. I mean, it made you realize that the UFOs are just, the study of UFOs, my view of it is, it's like an interesting intellectual exercise. Unless you've actually been abducted or something like that.
Yeah.
It's completely different. Or actually seen something, which I never have.
Not
but, 99.9% of the population, it's just, it's just a fun thing. It's in there with ghosts and Bigfoot and all that other stuff, which we can go into how it's all connected anyway, which is part of my magazine. The idea of the magazine. But to most people, it's not that interesting. And to the people who are interested in it, I think they've become a lot more circumspect about it. And one example is the National UFO Conference that has been going on. It's the longest running UFO conference, I think, might be in the world. But in the last couple of years, they've started presenting things that are fairly serious, pretty well grounded, and seem to point in a direction of trying to find answers through the data, rather than just having somebody come in and give you a laundry list of sightings, which is what used to happen at a lot of UFO conferences, or there'd be one case that was very interesting but really didn't go anywhere. I mean, it was like would kind of stand on their own, I think. But I think it's changed for the better because, like I said, people are a lot more careful about what they say and who they might want to believe. At least that's my impression. That thing, the Rex Heflin photo thing that I talked about earlier, that was presented last year at the National UFO Conference. That was the most it was the most interesting thing I'd seen in years at a UFO conference.
Huh.
Because it dealt with hard data with an actual witness that was still alive and photographs that backed up what he said. I don't know where that leaves us, but it lets us know that it's not just, it's something you can show to somebody and say, look, it wasn't something somebody imagined. There was something there, it was photographed, that left a physical trace, so it's not the imagination, and it's not it's not some ghost or something. It's some physical thing that was there, at least at that point for that witness.
So you think this has been an evolution past lights in the sky, and what I've witnessed from
Jack,
my own.
That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah. And from what I witnessed just from my own research and everything and observation of the field is that there seems to be an evolution toward like a disclosure movement. I don't really, that's probably the best way to put it.
And yeah, that's been building for a long time. And I was on a show a couple of months ago out here in L.A., and the producer there seemed absolutely convinced that there was going to be, based on, on different things, including that recent thing in Brazil where the government, the Air Force there, is actually opening up their files to UFO researchers, which I think is great. I don't know what else has come out since that. They haven't done a report on it yet. But he seemed to be convinced that for some reason, in the next few months, there was going to be this big disclosure and everything was going to be revealed. And he said, I was on the show, they said, what do you think of that? Don't you think it's a wonderful development? And I said, I'll believe it when I see it.
Exactly.
You know how many times people have said this? It's been said in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, a few times each, and nothing happens. Why do you think it's going to be different this time?
Well, do you think it'll ever happen?
I don't know. I think it will happen, but it's not going to be in the way that people want to or can, or maybe in a great part most people can understand or put together in some kind of coherent idea. I think it's just, important things are leaked out, and you just have to keep your nose to the grindstone and pull these things up and see how, over years and years, and see how well they fit together. There's a few people, I think Grant Cameron's doing that, and he's doing a pretty good job of it. That kind of thing, where he's got, his site's called presidentialufo.com. He just sits on things for years, and if there's something he thinks is important that matches up with something that's happened in the past, he will say, well, look, here Jimmy Carter said so-and-so in 1978, and now, and then Reagan said so-and-so, and then this case happened in Nevada that seems to, I can't think of a specific.
Yeah.
But that kind of research, that kind of disclosure, where something slips every once in a while, I think that is where the gold in the information will lie. And beyond that, I think that the U.S. government, I think it's very unpopular to say, but I don't think they know much more than we do. I think they know, they know more than we do, but they have no idea what to do with it.
Yeah, they don't know as much as the popular misconception might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's that John Keel, the joke he made years ago. the UFO community is not telling the Air Force what it knows about UFOs. it was a joke at the time, but it seems to make more sense as time goes on. And I think a lot of civilian researchers might be ahead of the government in what they're doing, which is why another reason why the government agencies are so interested in the subject, because they're going to get information from sources that they had no idea how. They had no idea how to go about it.
Yeah.
I think that's the other reason that the government's always been interested in the civilian UFO community, is that they're finding stuff out that they didn't know. So, yeah, they know probably, at least a little more, and maybe more than that than the general public. But as far as how to use that, they only know how to use it to solidify their power base, which is what they do anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to make you think we know a lot more than we do, just to scare you and keep you in line. That's old. That's as old as man. I mean, these are ideas that came. I use the example of the Art of War by the Chinese general from 500 BC or something like that. You use what you know, even if you don't know too much, to keep other people on their toes or off balance or whatever. And I think that's how they use it. And to us, it makes it look like they know everything and they're not telling us.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I don't know. That's an unpopular point of view, but as far as I can tell, I think that's what's happening.
It makes sense. I mean, it makes more sense than that they're sitting on a whole bunch of information that they can really keep secret.
Yeah. I mean, if it was that important, I don't know how secret they could keep it.
Yeah.
For the first thing out of a ufologist's mouth is, well, the aliens don't want to tell us either because they're scared of they're scared of the whole deal. But if they've got that much power, I think they could, like Whitley Strieber says, I think they're revealing things to us just from the bottom up. They got tired. If they're around here, and there's a separate, you know, there are aliens wherever they come from, I think they're going to reveal things from the bottom up. Not they're not going to tell everybody at the top, because they know that whatever they say is going to be garbled so much by the time it gets to us, it's just going to be have no relationship to what they're trying to tell us.
Yeah.
And that presence has been around, you know, for thousands and thousands and thousands of years.
So, like, a lot of people think that the disclosure might happen, but it'll be on their terms. Or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be on their terms, and it'll be the way they want it to happen, and maybe abductions are part of that. I don't know. Maybe that stuff going on in Mexico is part of that. I don't know.
Who knows?
So, you know, even if the government revealed what it knows, I don't think we really know much. We probably know what Roswell was, and we probably know, you know, what that thing was flying over Texas that irradiated those people, which I've got a pretty good idea what it is, et cetera. So it's people are looking for answers from a place I don't think they're going to come from.
Yeah, and in light of your book, at least I know the ufology community sure probably wouldn't believe official government disclosure anyway. I think there would be a lot of people.
You know what they believe? They believe what they expect. And that's the problem with it. They expect to hear that it's aliens from another planet, they're abducting us, and they're all powerful, and they come in, you know, saucer-shaped flying things, and they've been doing it since Kenneth Arnold. That's what everybody expects and wants to hear. Now, something else, if, you know, whatever it is, I don't think people could get their minds around it. I don't think I could. Because I don't think we can think in the way that it actually is, if there actually is an is associated with it, if you know what I mean.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, we're trapped in linear time-space relationship that we've been taught and is reinforced by our senses and the way we live and the way science has been since I don't know how long. And if we are presented with, it's like that Oz factor. People will see something weird. There'll be something in the sky or something in the room next to them. There'll be, you know, two or three people will see something. Wow, multiple witnesses. They'll wake up in the morning. They won't talk about it. They'll go, wow, what was that? And 20 years later, after nobody said a word about it, somebody says, remember that time when we were in the kitchen and all the lights went out and, you know, and they haven't thought about it for 20 years at all. And somebody just suddenly says, oh, yeah, and, you know, it was like, oh, the aliens did something to them and made them forget. But what I think it is, and this is an idea from Dean Radin, who I interviewed, is that your mind doesn't have a box to put it in.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a category for it, mm-hmm. for whatever it was that happened, because your senses are trying to make sense of it in a, you know, A to B, 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, moving from this place to this place sense, and it's not that kind of sense. It's not that kind of experience. You're the way you've been taught to look at things and experience things is not the way that they actually happened. I'm using a lot of loaded terms here.
Yeah, but I think it's a hard, it's an ephemeral concept really to grasp.
And then now put that in the context of somebody coming on the news and announcing, well, time is an illusion. Things don't work the way you think they do, and that's where these entities live and how they interact with us. People are going to go, ha, what?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying that's what would happen, but just as an example, there's no way to explain it in the terms that we have in our language and the way we think. That's what I think is going on. So it just stays in this little box somewhere that we can't put it in, and then little bits of it come out that make sense to us. Flying saucers, aliens with big eyes, traces on the ground, you know, jets chasing something. That makes sense to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, something that happened in the no space and the no time, starting to sound like a drug addict or something. Somebody's taking too many psychedelics, which I assure you I'm not. But there's no way to describe that. So if you're going to disclose something you can't describe, how can you do it?
Yeah.
there you have it. That was this week's edition of Banal of America Audio Season 1. I want to thank Greg Bishop for sitting down and talking to me for so long, and we're going to continue this conversation next week with Part 2 of 2, the Greg Bishop interview, discussing Project Beta, ufology, and a host of other stuff. For those of you who didn't catch it, his website is www.excludedmiddle.com. That's excludedmiddle.com. And, of course, my website is binallofamerica.com, www.binallofamerica.com. Big thanks to Leslie and Chiron of binallofamerica.com for your help and support with the audio series and the website. And, of course, thank you, everyone out there listening. Hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of Banal of America Audio Season 1, and I hope you stop by again next week for more madness from Banal of America. Until next week, this is Tim Banal saying so long, everybody.